You're tuned to the Sharona on Laguna's KX 93.5. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight is be yourself, maybe not so much. My topic is inspired in part by an article I read in the Times by Adam Grant, who's a professor of management and psychology at the Wharton School of University of Penn. He's author also of a book called Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. So, of course, his view on things appealed to my rather perverse nature. But I also like to look at the flip side of things, and while be authentic and be yourself is the mantra these days, Adam Grant takes a rather interesting other perspective. He talks in this article about preparing himself for the biggest presentation of his life, his appearance at TED, and I'll play you a little bit of the talk he gave there later on in the show. And he said it was when he was confessing his frustration with 7 drafts of that talk that he'd thrown away. His colleagues and friends, 2-1, said, "The most important thing is to be yourself." He thought about this and realized that we're in an age where being yourself is the defining advice in life, love, and career. It's the age of authenticity, which means there should be no difference between what you firmly believe inside and what you reveal to the outside world in order to let our true selves be seen. Apparently, in university commencement speeches, be true to yourself is one of the most common themes, close up behind expand your horizons and just ahead of never give up. Oprah Winfrey said jokingly a few years ago, "I certainly had no idea that being your authentic self could get you as rich as I've become. If I'd known that, I'd have tried it a lot earlier." But we can't all be Oprah Winfrey, and for most people, be yourself, according to psychologist Adam Grant, is terrible advice. He says, nobody wants to see your true self. We all have thoughts and feelings that we believe are fundamental to our lives, but better left unspoken. Some 10 years ago, A.J. Jacobs, an author, spent a few weeks trying to be totally authentic. He announced to an editor that he would try to sleep with her if he were single. He informed his nanny that he would like to go on a date with her if his wife left him. He informed a friend's 5-year-old daughter that the beetle in her hands was not napping, but dead. He told his in-laws that the conversation was boring. So you can imagine how his experiment worked out. Deceit makes our world go around, he concluded. Without lies, marriages would crumble, workers would be fired, egos would be shattered, governments would collapse. So, are you somebody who aims for authenticity? Apparently, that would depend on a personality trait called self-monitoring. If you're a high self-monitor, you're constantly scanning your environment for social cues and making adjustments accordingly. You hate social awkwardness and desperately want to avoid offending anyone. But if you're a low self-monitor, you're more guided by your inner state, regardless of your circumstances. Adam Grant gives us an example, a study where people were given a steak to eat. The high self-monitors tasted it before pouring salt on it, whereas the low self-monitors salted it first, as if they already knew their salt personalities very well. Low self-monitors criticize high self-monitors as chameleons and phonies, and they're right that there's a time and a place for authenticity. Low self-monitors, according to some research, tend to have happier marriages and lower odds of divorce. Maybe with your romantic partner, being authentic might lead to a more genuine connection, but in the rest of our lives, we pay a high price for being too authentic. Now, high self-monitors, those are the people who know to adjust to social mores and want to avoid offending anyone, advance faster and earn higher status, partly because they're so concerned about their reputations, and though you might think that that would seem to reward some self-promoting frauds, there's also the fact that high self-monitors spend a lot of time trying to discern what others need of them and helping them. In an analysis of 136 studies of more than 23,000 employees, it was discovered that high self-monitors received significantly higher evaluations and were more likely to be promoted into leadership positions. Interestingly, women are more likely to be low self-monitors than men, in other words, less concerned with their reputations, perhaps because they face stronger cultural pressures to express their feelings. On the other hand, that puts them at risk for being judged weak or unprofessional. When a woman was promoted to general manager of a group at Hewlett-Packard, she apparently told her 5,300 employees that the job was scary and told them, "I need your help." She was being authentic, but her team lost confidence in her initially, which would suggest that low self-monitoring can have harmful effects on women's progress in a business environment. But even some high self-monitors can believe in authenticity as an expression of a true self that's a combination of our convictions and abilities. However, merely believing that there's a fixed self can interfere with growth. Children, for instance, who see abilities as fixed will give up after failure. Managers who believe talent is fixed will fail to coach their employees. Professor of organizational behavior said that a too rigid self-concept when we're looking to change our game becomes an anchor that keeps us from sailing forth. Well, we all want to sail forth. So, if we're not striving to become our authentic selves, then what should we be striving for? According to the literary critic Lionel Trilling, the answer is sincerity. Instead of searching for our inner selves and then trying to express those inner selves, Lionel Trilling urged us to start with our outer selves, to pay attention to how we present ourselves to others, and then to strive to be the people we claim to be. In other words, rather than changing from the inside out, bring the outside in. I love that idea. Just a quick interruption of myself to tell you you're listening to The Sharer Now. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. I'm examining whether being your authentic self is a good or a not-so-rewarding mantra, and I'm quoting from a New York Times piece by psych professor Adam Grant. He talks about high self-monitors, those who are very concerned with how they appear to others, and low self-monitors, those who aren't. When Herminia Ibarra, this professor of organizational behavior, studied consultants and investment bankers, she found that high self-monitors were more likely than their authentic peers to experiment with different leadership styles. They examined and borrowed from senior leaders in their organizations and practiced their behaviors and mimicked their actions until they became second nature. So, not authentic, but sincere, and it made them more effective. The shift from authenticity to sincerity could be especially important for millennials, suggests Professor Adam Grant. We know from various researchers that this younger generation tends to be less concerned about social approval, and that works very well for them until their employers start to look at their social media profiles. Adam Grant said for himself, as an introvert, he was terrified of public speaking, so his authentic self wouldn't have been offered a TED talk in the first place. But since he was so passionate about sharing knowledge, he spent the next decade learning to do what the psychologist Dr. Little calls acting out of character. He decided to be the person he claimed to be, someone comfortable in the spotlight, and it worked. So, next time people say just be yourself, he suggests, stop them in their tracks. No one wants to hear everything that's in your head. They just want you to live up to what comes out of your mouth. Speaking of which, you are tuned to The Sharer Now on Laguna's one and only KX93.5. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight concerns not being yourself, but also not totally inventing yourself, rather being that part of yourself that other people see in you as admirable or extraordinary, and sticking to that script so that ultimately that's who you become. Muhammad Ali just died. You knew him as Muhammad Ali, I and those of my generation knew him as Cassius Clay originally, which was his name at birth and when he started fighting. But Cassius Clay is a slave name, he said. He said, I didn't choose it and I don't want it. He was, in fact, the grandson of a slave. And when he joined the Nation of Islam, he adopted a Muslim name. I am Muhammad Ali from now on, he said. It's a free name. It means beloved of God. And I'm going to insist people use it when they speak to me or of me. He became a boxer because, he said, I thought it was the fastest way for a black person to make it in this country. And make it he did, winning a gold medal in the light heavyweight division of the Rome Summer Olympics in 1960. And then throwing that medal in the Ohio River, he claimed in his autobiography, because he'd been denied service at a restaurant. He was the creator of his own legendary status as the greatest. Not the greatest boxer, just the greatest. I am the greatest, was what he'd always proclaim, explaining that the difference between other boxers and himself was, you've never heard of them. He was originally dubbed Gaseous Cassius because of his ardent self-promotion. He once said, I'm so fast that last night I turned off the light switch in my hotel room and was in bed before the room was dark. What he didn't say, and what he was unlikely to let the world know about him as he was building his mythic self, was that he was shaking when he got to that hotel room because he was terrified of airplanes. In fact, when he went to Rome for the Olympics where he won his gold medal, he bought a parachute along for his airplane trip there. Gaseous Cassius said, a rooster crows when it sees the light, but not before. In the dark, he'll never crow. I've seen the light and I'm crowing. He was aware that he was his own construction. He once told a journalist, I know why Parkinson's happened to me. It's God showing me that I'm just a man like everyone else. He's showing you too, he said. You can learn from me that way.
World. He got a fake wannabe, trying to be a pimp. He dresses like a Dapper Don, but even in jeans, he's a godsend original, the man of my dreams. Yes, my man says he loves me, never says he loves me not. Mine, I rush me good and touch me in the right spot. See all the guys that I've had, they try to play all that math, but every time they tried, I said, that's not it. But not this man, he's got the right potion. Baby, rub it down and make it smooth like lotion. Yeah, the ritual, highway to heaven. From 7 to 7, he's got me open like 7-Eleven. And yes, it's me that he's always choosing. With him, I'm never losing, and he knows that my name is not Susan. He always has heavy conversations over mine, which means a lot to me, cause good men are hard to find. My man gives real love, and that's why I call him killer. He's not a wham bam, thank you ma'am, he's a thriller. He takes his time and does everything right. Knocks me out with one shot for the rest of the night. He's a real smooth brother, never in a rush. And he gives me goose pimples with every single touch. Spends quality time with his kids when he can. Secure in his manhood, cause he's a real man. A lover and a fighter and a knocker, knocker out. Don't take him for a sucker, cause it's not what he's about. Every time I need him, he always got my back. Never disrespectful, cause his mama taught him that. I got a good man.
What a man, what a man, what a mighty good man.
He's a mighty, mighty.
tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 93.5. Talking about what a good man, here's actor Will Smith and his views as related to my topic tonight about being yourself, or maybe being more than yourself, the best and greatest self you can be.
I study the patterns of the universe. There's a redemptive power that making a choice has, rather than feeling like you're at effect to all the things that are happening. Make a choice, right? You just decide what it's going to be, who you're going to be, how you're going to do it. Just decide. And then from that point, the universe is going to get out your way. It's water. It wants to move and go around stuff.
Greatness is not this wonderful, esoteric, elusive, godlike feature that only the special among us will ever taste. It's something that truly exists in all of us. It's very simple. This is what I believe, and I'm willing to die for it, period. It's that simple. I know who I am, I know what I believe, and that's all I need to know. So from there, you do what you need to do. We didn't grow up with the sense that where we were was where we were going to be. You know, we grew up with the sense that where we were almost didn't matter because we were becoming something greater. And I think we make this more complex than it has to be.
I've never really viewed myself as particularly talented. Where I excel is ridiculous, sickening work ethic. You know, while the other guy's sleeping, I'm working. While the other guy's eating, I'm working. The separation of talent and skill is one of the greatest misunderstood concepts for people who are trying to excel, who have dreams, that want to do things. Talent you have naturally. Skill is only developed by hours and hours and hours of beating on your craft. The only thing that I see that is distinctly different about me is I'm not afraid to die on a treadmill. You might have more talent than me. You might be smarter than me, but if we get on the treadmill together, you're getting off first or I'm going to die. It's really that simple.
According to the 60 Minute piece, apparently when Will Smith was 12 and his brother was 9, their father ripped out a brick wall in front of his business and told Will and his brother to rebuild it. They said they couldn't, it was impossible, and their dad said, no, you're going to do it. It took them a year and a half, but they did.
And he said, now don't you ever tell me it's something that you can do.
You don't set out to build a wall. You don't say, I'm going to build the biggest, baddest, greatest wall that's ever been built. You don't start there. You say, I'm going to lay this brick as perfectly as a brick can be laid. And you do that every single day.
And you have a wall.
And soon you have a wall.
I want to represent an idea. I want to represent possibilities. I want to represent the idea that you really can make what you want. One of my favorite books is The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho. And I believe that I can create whatever I want to create.
I think that there's a certain delusional quality that all successful people have to have. You have to believe that something different than what has happened for the last 50 million years of history, you have to believe that something different can happen.
Being realistic is the most commonly traveled road to mediocrity. What's the point of being realistic? Why would you be realistic? I'm going to do it. It's done. The second I decide it's done, it's already done. It's now we just got to wait for y'all to see. Confucius said, he who says he can and he who says he can't are both usually right.
Will Smith goes on to make the point that it's unrealistic to enter a room, flick a switch, and expect light to come on, but Edison knew it could be real. It was considered unrealistic for a metal room to be able to lift off this earth and enter the sky and look down, but the Wright brothers didn't care that others thought it was unrealistic. They thought it was realistic. Every earth-shattering innovation has been made by somebody who had a vision of something that everyone else thought was unrealistic. And The ones who didn't let others discourage them were able to implement their visions through humongous effort and belief that the impossible was possible. Will Smith's point is that if it's realistic to you, then with greatness of dedication and spirit and craft and hard work, you can realize it. Being greater than yourself, being more or other, relates to my topic on tonight's Sharon Hour. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only listener-supported, member-supported public FM radio station, KX93.5.
I'm motivated by fear. Fear of fear. I hate being scared to do something.
I realize that to have the level of success that I want to have, it takes such a desperate, obsessive focus with all of your fiber and all of your heart and all of your creativity.
And I think what developed in my early days was I started attacking things that I was scared of.
In his film, The Pursuit of Happiness, Will Smith, now a father himself, passes the message on to his son.
Don't ever let somebody tell you you can't do something. Not even me, all right? You got a dream, you got to protect it. People can't do something themselves. They want to tell you you can't do it. You want something, go get it, period.
Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Brighter.
Someday, yeah, we'll put it together and we'll get it undone. Someday when your head is much lighter. Someday, yeah, we'll walk in the rays of a beautiful sun. Someday when the world is much brighter.
Things will be brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna be easier. Ooh, child, things will be brighter.
You're tuned to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX93.5. I'm Sharon James, and my topic on tonight's show is about the choice to either be yourself or be a better, bigger, kinder, nicer, stronger, braver version of yourself. One of the most popular TED Talks in recent years was by a young woman named Amy Cuddy, who proposed that just changing your posture and standing in front of the mirror telling yourself you were great and capable and brilliant was enough to transform you into that confident, stand-tall person you aspired to be. That talk ended up going viral and was immensely popular. People took that little nugget of advice to obviously great and far-reaching effect. It's funny because Saturday Night Live had this character, Stuart Smalley, with his daily affirmations, a parody of a motivational speaker who, in a lisping voice, said, "I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me." Here, I'll play a bit for you.
I deserve good things. I am entitled to my share of happiness. I refuse to beat myself up. I am an attractive person. I am fun to be with.
Daily Affirmation with Stuart Smalley. Stuart Smalley is a caring nurturer, a member of several 12-step programs, but not a licensed therapist.
I'm going to do a terrific show today, and I'm going to help people because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
In a twist of fate, or maybe living proof of this character he invented, proof that daily affirmations really work, the actual comedian who invented that character and parodied him, Al Franken, went on to become a U.S. senator, taking his own ironic advice. And then there was a talk I heard by a woman who goes and helps people unclutter their living spaces. She told the story of a woman who was absolutely miserable, who lived in a house that was a complete mess and presumably full to the gills with accumulated stuff. Her advice to that woman was to pretend that her house was actually a luxurious Manhattan high-rise apartment that was worth $3 million, so long as it was cleared of all the junk and made beautiful and pristine. So it was incumbent on her to do that. And by pretending that she lived in this luxury apartment and that it was her job to clear out the mess left by the previous owner, she was able to get up every day and do that job. So there's something to pretending you're a different person or being a different character in your own life that leads you to greater heights, maybe, than just being yourself. And that's my topic on tonight's Sharon Hour. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX93.5. I don't know if you've heard of the process of visualization, listener, the practice of picturing the better, richer, more successful person you intend to be. People swear by vision boards. They cut out places they want to live in, the houses they want to see themselves in, the spouses they want to be married to, anything they see in a painting, a drawing, a photo, maybe a magazine that grabs at their heart and makes them think, that's going to be me, and they make a vision board. And I know it's really worked for a few people I know in their life and loves.
It took so long. Still I believe somehow the one that I needed would find me eventually. I had a vision of love, and it was all that you've given to me.
Sweet!
tuned to the Sharona on Laguna's KX 93.5. I'm Sharon James, and my topic on tonight's show is about being yourself, or being something better, something or someone that you aspire to be, and focusing on that as the end game of who you are, rather than who you are at this particular moment. The comedian Jim Carrey famously wrote himself a $10 million check for acting services rendered. This was when he was penniless and just dreaming of becoming a famous comedian and actor. Completely broke, he would go up and sit in his car on Mulholland and picture himself with a director of his choice, making an impression and getting a part. So he wrote himself this check for $10 million, dated it Thanksgiving 1995, which was 3 or 5 years hence. And just before Thanksgiving 1995, he'd come up through the ranks, been recognized for his work on Saturday Night Live. He booked Dumb and Dumber for $10 million. Now, there's more to just picturing it. You can't just picture it and that be it. You've got to be honing your craft, working very hard, putting yourself in the right environment, and totally focused on doing all the things you need to do to achieve those things you want. As Jim Carrey says in a conversation with Oprah,
can't just visualize and then, you know, go eat a sandwich.
But if something grabs your focus so entirely, engages you so completely, if you have that passion for something, it's an easier route there. And you've got to have the confidence and the fake it till you make it attitude as well, and not getting discouraged or wavering from that desire. Of course, we don't all have that. We don't all know what we want. And so we live with ourselves. We choose to be the most ourselves we can be. And we muddle through, having our highs and lows. And we congratulate ourselves for living an authentic life rather than a pie-in-the-sky one, where we have our feet firmly embedded on the ground. But there's a niggling voice that's not enough for us. It wouldn't hurt for us to go experiment with the things that really excite us. Something else Jim Carrey said is, for all this dissent and hatred and acrimony in the world, we do pretty well living at such close quarters with each other, just getting along with each other.
I'm amazed when people go like, the world is insane, it's crazy, it's out of control, people are completely nuts. Seriously, we live on a planet where we're very crammed together, and I think we do really well. It's just that when we watch the news and we watch entertainment, it's about people's conflicts tied together in the most exciting possible way. And you imagine that the world is this explosive, horrifying place. And the news is all this negativity condensed. And it really is not representative of what the world is or wants.
Jim Carrey is up on a podium because he's learned some things and wants to share his insights, he says, with as many people as possible. And sharing can be a cause in itself, I would hope. It's what I try to do on this Share an Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX 93.5. Sharing things, interesting and or elucidating information or physical things or practical care can make you more force within the universe rather than necessarily having to stand out yourself. Which, to quote Will Smith, usually takes a ton of hard work and honing either your social skills or your craft, whatever that may be, or usually both, but also opportunity. Chance is a huge part of the equation. And there was a wonderful film in the 70s starring a character called Chance, a gardener. The film was Being There by hotshot screenwriter at the time, Jerzy Kaczynski. It starred the famous British comedian Peter Sellers, and it's a perfect example of other people's perception of a person creating a person that doesn't exist until that person grows into the projection of others. Such was the case with Kaczynski's subject, who was actually enslaved by his very powerful and domineering employer, who lived in a big castle and had lots of companies sort of representing the ultimate corporate being. Chance was his gardener, and a chance encounter with a rich society woman, played by Shirley MacLaine, turned him into Chancey Gardner, proper English gentleman. The way he chose to express himself and his laconic style led one person and then an entire country to believe that this plain-spoken man with zero social skills was an undiscovered genius and should be considered a suitable candidate for President of the United States. It's rather funny, actually, when you think about it in today's context. In effect, Chance was a completely uneducated and illiterate man whose authoritarian boss and proprietor, if you will, had kept him locked up so that all he knew of life was what he saw on television. And that's what he thought life was, because he'd never been exposed to it other than being allowed outside to work the garden. Here's a trailer from that film just to give you a taste of it.
May I ask your name?
Chancey Gardner.
Mr. Chancey Gardner. Are you related to Basil and Perdita Gardner?
No, I'm not related to Basil and Perdita.
You know, Chancey, there's something about you. You don't play games with words to protect yourself.
On television, Mr. President, you look much smaller.
Dumb as a jackass. Had no brains at all. Was stuffed with rice pudding between the ears.
As long as the roots are not severed, all is well. And all will be well in the garden.
In the garden? Coffin, I'll need some information on Mr. Chauncey Gardner's background.
What do you mean he's got no background? That's impossible.
Mr. Gardner, the New York Times spoke of your peculiar brand of optimism. What was your reaction to that?
I do not know what it means.
Ho, he was very clever, keeping it at a third grade level. That's what they understand.
But I think he's brilliant.
It's always somewhat surprising to find men like yourself working so intimately with the president and yet somehow managing to remain relatively unknown.
Yes, it is surprising.
Listen to that boy.
I'm Chance, the gardener.
The gardener?
Yes. Since I was a child, I worked in this garden.
Then you really are a gardener?
Oh, yes.
I raised that boy. And look at him now.
I heard he speaks eight languages.
I can't write. I can't read.
I like to watch TV.
All you gotta be is white in America to get whatever you want.
Chance the Gardener, a.k.a. Chancey Gardner, provides the perfect example of how not being yourself, but rather being someone's projection of who you are, can actually propel you in today's world, in this country, to great heights. Which relates to the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight, with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 93.5. That topic is about being yourself. So how difficult should that be? Well, first we have to know who we are, how we define ourselves, or more importantly, how we would like to define ourselves. Listen to social worker Brené Brown in her TED Talk.
A couple years ago, an event planner called me because I was going to do a speaking event, and she called and she said, I'm really struggling with how to write about you on the little flyer. And I thought, well, what's the struggle? And she said, well, I saw you speak, and I'm going to call you a researcher, I think, but I'm afraid if I call you a researcher, no one will come because they'll think you're boring and irrelevant. But the thing I liked about your talk is you're a storyteller, so I think what I'll do is just call you a storyteller. And of course, the academic, insecure part of me was like, oh, why not Magic Pixie? Let me think about this for a second. And so I tried to call deep on my courage, and I thought, you know, I am a storyteller. I'm a qualitative researcher. I collect stories. That's what I do. And maybe stories are just data with a soul. So I said, you know what? Why don't you just say I'm a researcher storyteller? And she went, there's no such thing. So I'm a researcher storyteller. So I want to talk to you and tell some stories about a piece of my research that fundamentally expanded my perception and really actually changed the way that I live and love and work and parent. When I was a young researcher, doctoral student, I had a research professor who said to us, if you cannot measure it, it does not exist. And I thought, really? And he's like, absolutely. So you have to understand, I was getting my PhD in social work. So my entire academic career was surrounded by people who kind of believed in the life's messy, love it. And I'm more the life's messy, clean it up, organize it. And so I thought, this is the career for me. Because I am interested in some messy topics, but I want to be able to make them not messy. You know that situation where you get an evaluation from your boss, and she tells you 37 things that you do really awesome and one thing that you can get an opportunity for growth. And all you can think about is that opportunity for growth. Well, apparently this is the way my work went as well. Because when you ask people about love, they tell you about heartbreak. When you ask people about belonging, they'll tell you their most excruciating experiences of being excluded. And when you ask people about connection, the stories they told me were about disconnection. And so I pulled back out of the research and thought, I need to figure out what this is. And it turned out to be shame. And shame is really easily understood as the fear of disconnection. Is there something about me that if other people know it or see it, I won't be worthy of connection? Shame is universal. We all have it. The only people who don't experience shame have no capacity for human empathy or connection. No one wants to talk about it, and the less you talk about it, the more you have it. The thing that underpinned this I'm not good enough, I'm not blank enough, I'm not thin enough, rich enough, beautiful enough, smart enough, promoted enough, was excruciating vulnerability. This idea of, in order for connection to happen, we have to allow ourselves to be seen, really seen. I hate vulnerability, and so I thought, this is my chance to beat it back with my measuring stick. I'm going in, I'm going to figure this stuff out, I'm going to spend a year, I'm going to totally deconstruct shame, I'm going to understand how vulnerability works, and I'm going to outsmart it. So I was ready, and I was really excited. As you know, it's not going to turn out well.
There is a girl in the front of my class who I swear I never seen do anything but love. She's tall and she's smart, beautiful and strong, and when someone's down, she tries to fix what is wrong. How does someone so perfect feel so insecure as to scar her skin with cuts and burns and still want to hurt more? How does someone so loving learn to hate her own guts, drawing a picture on her arms with a blade as if her mind isn't dark enough? There is a girl in the front of my class whose eyes are glazed over like newly cut glass. The ghost of a smile inside her face, and she laughs as I tell her who's on first base. Now does someone so perfect feel so insecure as to scar skin with cuts and burns and still want to hurt more? How does someone so loving learn to hate her own guts, drawing a picture on her arm with a blade as if her mind isn't dark enough? There is a girl in the front of my class, a society you find it rare to see a smile alive. Her friends tell her jokes like that one with the guy, but all she does is close her eyes and enter her mind. How does someone so perfect feel so insecure as to scar her skin with cuts and burns and still want to hurt more? How does someone so loving learn to hate her own guts, drawing a picture on her arms with blade as if her mind isn't dark enough for imperfections? There was a girl in the front of for my clients who yesterday took the breath that was our lives. She wrote a few notes, I'm sorry, didn't say, but my mind was messed up, you couldn't save me anyway. And to the girl in the back of the class, I feel the way I did. How does someone so perfect feel so insecure? As the scar skin with cuts and burns and still want to hurt more.
You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. Sad song, that. Shame can kill. It does inevitably kill, figuratively and literally. If it doesn't kill you, it can kill others around you. We've just seen massive examples of it. The misfit, killing the popular kids and then himself. The latent homosexual, killing the homosexuals. Shame is a bad emotion to live with, undealt with. Shame affects the young more. It tends to dissipate with age. Not always a good thing in the short term, acceptance, but a coping mechanism. We understand as we get older that everybody has their own form of it. Call it shame, call it insecurity, feeling lesser than others. Anyway, all of this made me think about an article I'd read by Lisa Barrett, professor of psychology at Northeastern University, on the concept of emotional granularity. As I understand this concept, emotional granularity is about refining your emotions so that they don't just go under a blanket overall emotion, like I feel bad. So, for example, if you read about some awful thing that's happened to a child or just some senseless bit of violence, then you actually define the emotion you're feeling to that particular incident and you title it frustration or exasperation or fury. It won't devolve into just a general malaise, as it were. For instance, when you're watching this year's presidential campaigning, you might feel embarrassed or irritated. This emotional granularity is all about having a more defined vocabulary so that you can actually pinpoint what you're feeling. Professor Barrett mentions that these tailored emotional experiences are actually good for you, even if they're negative experiences, because they give you an agility at regulating your emotion. And people with emotional granularity are less likely to drink excessively when stressed, or retaliate aggressively against someone who's hurt them. They use medication less frequently and generally have longer, healthier lives because they're in tune with their emotions, which means they're going to get a surge of cortisol, that fight or flight hormone, when they're feeling these things, which you don't get if you just have a general feeling of awfulness. The body hasn't recognized that you're in a particular state of emotion. But it does recognize it if you label with specific words what you're feeling. And the more particular those words, the better your emotional health. Because these are like little pointers to the brain. Your brain plays a big part in constructing your emotional state. So the more your brain is challenged by the more particular descriptions of that emotional state, the more it can learn to cope with them more particularly. If they remain undefined, you could just sink into that overall state of despair without your brain tuning into it till it's too late. You're already in a kind of generic, undefined funk. So learning more words to express yourself is better for the brain because it keeps it more agile emotionally. One Yale study showed school children who learn more emotional concepts have better social behavior and improved academic performance. Emotional concepts are like tools for living. The bigger and more diverse your toolkit, the better you're able to handle whatever comes along in life. For social worker Brené Brown, vulnerability, her fear of appearing vulnerable, her shame of it, was what she set about working on for the cause of being her true self. Being yourself your better self, or better than yourself, is my topic on tonight's Sharon Hour. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 93.5. What social worker and researcher Brené Brown's research led her to discover was that she was not alone in her fear, in her shame.
Here's what I can tell you that shame boils down to, and this may be one of the most important things that I've ever learned in the decade of doing this research. My 1 year has turned into 6 years, thousands of stories, and I kind of got a handle on it. I kind of understood this is what shame is, this is how it works. I wrote a book, I published a theory, but something was not okay. And what it was is that if I roughly took the people I interviewed, there was only one variable that separated the people who have a strong sense of love and belonging and folks who struggle for it, always wondering if they're good enough. The people who have a strong sense of love and belonging believe they're worthy of love and belonging. They believe they're worthy. The one thing that keeps us out of connection is our fear that we're not worthy of connection, was something that personally and professionally I felt like I needed to understand better. So what I did is I took all of the interviews where I saw worthiness, where I saw people living that way, and just looked at those. What do these people have in common? Here's what I found. What they had in common was a sense of courage. And I want to separate courage and bravery for you for a minute. Courage, the original definition was from the Latin word cur, meaning heart, and the original definition was to tell the story of who you are with your whole heart. And so these folks had, very simply, the courage to be imperfect. They had the compassion to be kind to themselves first and then to others, because as it turns out, we can't practice compassion with other people if we can't treat ourselves kindly. And the last was they had connection, and this was the hard part, as a result of authenticity. They were willing to let go of who they thought they should be in order to be who they were, which you have to for connection.
You're tuned to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX 93.5. I'm Sharon James, and my topic on tonight's show is about being yourself. We've explored the options of pretending to be someone else, heard stories about pretending to be somewhere else, and now social worker and researcher Brené Brown's research has revealed that the reasons a lot of us are frightened about being ourselves is it exposes our shame and makes us vulnerable. And that the people who successfully managed to be themselves were people who had let go of the idea of being perfect.
They fully embraced vulnerability. They didn't talk about vulnerability being comfortable, nor did they really talk about it being excruciating, as I had heard earlier in the shame interviewing. They just talked about it being necessary. They talked about the willingness to say, I love you first, to invest in a relationship that may or may not work out, the willingness to do something where there are no guarantees, to breathe through waiting for the doctor to call after your mammogram. They thought this was fundamental. I personally was struggling. So I found a therapist. And this is a therapist who sees therapists. My first meeting with her, Diana, she said, what's going on? And I said, I'm struggling. And she said, what's the struggle? And I said, well, I have a vulnerability issue. And I know that vulnerability is kind of the core of shame and fear and our struggle for worthiness, but it appears that it's also the birthplace of joy, of creativity, of belonging, of love. And I think I have a problem and I need some help. But here's the thing, no family stuff, no childhood shit. I just need some strategies. And it took about a year. And for me, it was a year-long street fight. It was a slugfest. Vulnerability pushed, I pushed back. I lost the fight, but probably won my life back. So then I went back into the research and spent the next couple of years really trying to understand, why do we struggle with vulnerability so much? Am I alone in struggling with vulnerability? Having to ask for help because I'm sick, initiating sex, being turned down, asking someone out, waiting for the doctor to call back, getting laid off, laying off people. We live in a vulnerable world. And one of the ways we deal with it is we numb vulnerability. We are the most in debt, obese, addicted, and medicated adult cohort in U.S. history. The problem is, and I learned this from the research, that you cannot selectively numb emotion. You can't say, here's the bad stuff. Here's vulnerability. Here's grief. Here's shame. Here's fear. Here's disappointment. I don't want to feel these. I'm going to have a couple of beers and a banana nut muffin. You can't numb those hard feelings. without numbing the other affects or emotions. You cannot selectively numb. So when we numb those, we numb joy. We numb gratitude. We numb happiness.
I see an open door where you've put up a wall, and I'll be walking through to disarm you any second now. If you come easily, I'll handle you with care. But if you struggle, I'll besiege you with temptation. 'Cause love won't heal your heart if you deny it. Don't knock it till you try it. We are all afraid to die. But if you're too scared of living, don't try. Don't even. If you want out, I'm leaving. Goodbye. Don't even try. I'll put you in your place. Just show me where it is. I'll carry you up high to the summit of contentment. And you could read my mind if you were not so colorblind. I'll be yours and you'll be fine, just as long as we're not thinking. 'Cause love won't break your heart if you don't let it get up into your head. It wouldn't tear your faith apart. So if you want, just come and get it. But if you think you might regret it, then we might as well forget it. Nah, don't even start. Don't even start.
No, do. Unfortunately, your start is the end of my share now tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. My topic tonight related to being yourself. So what can we conclude? Is that the best we can aspire to be ourselves? Is that what we should be? Or should we aspire to be something other, someone better? Maybe it's a combination, a concoction of our natural ingredients. Like a sponge cake, we can be a basic, unadorned sponge cake. We can be an insane pineapple upside-down cake, or we can turn everything on its head, adorn ourselves with fresh, plump, succulent berries and cream, and become a strawberry fool. Actually, there's really no sponge cake in strawberry fool. So strawberry trifle. It's just the same basic ingredients, presented in different ways. Our choice as to what kind of sponge we'll be. If you want to hear this show again, or any of my previous ones, go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. Or you can listen on your iPhone on iTunes. And do tune in again for more topics and fun next Sunday night at 6:00.